Thank you, Rob. And again, good morning. It's good to be with you on this beautiful Sunday morning. Today we conclude a long series from the Gospel of Matthew. We began actually back in June, and we've been focusing on the middle part of Matthew. We've learned about the demands and delights of discipleship, and today's text is no exception, and the context is critical. This story is set in the calm before the storm, during Holy Week, between Palm Sunday and Good Friday. And despite the testing and the taunting, Jesus keeps teaching, and he is rolling out some of his best stuff ever in these final days. Religious leaders are trying to shut him up, but he has a way of shutting them down. They question his authority, but do not play jeopardy with Jesus. He responds with another question, and they are clueless. Jesus has already literally turned over the temple tables, and now he turns over the theological tables, and they are dumbfounded. And then he pounds home his point with another pointed parable, and Jesus gets our attention again 2,000 years later. How does he do that? Wow. You know, like last week's perplexing parable, this story gets played out in a variety of situations and circumstances in our own lives as well. Do we know someone at work who lacks motivation? Do we know someone who says yes but never delivers? Have we heard unfulfilled promises from politicians? Certainly not. No, I'm sorry. There are many more on the way for months. Do you have family members who put off tasks and procrastinate? I confess that I have done that with Ellen when she asks, when are you going to get around to doing that, honey? And my response right now is when I retire. But I've only used that excuse for the past 4 or 5 years. So anyway, I'll milk that as long as I can. I've got another month. Anyway, our frustrations about these kinds of things are expressed in memorable one-liners. They've become cliches almost. You know, actions speak louder than words. I would rather see a sermon than hear one. The great end of life is not knowledge, but action, C.S. Lewis quipped. People cannot remain just good eggs forever. They either have to hatch or rot. In other words, get with it. A cartoon I regularly read is Dustin, and there have been two of them recently that seem to have been penned for this parable. In one, Dustin is a young man. Of course, he can't hold on to a job, and so he frequently visits his employment counselor to get some help. In a reference, she did not want to lie, and so she wrote these words about him. If you can get Dustin to work for you, you'll be very fortunate. In another cartoon last week, he asked his counselor, the data firm fired me? They liked me. I thought they liked me. And she said they did like you. They told me that when you do your work, you do it with a smile. They need someone to work with a computer. Anyway, Jesus kind of hooks us when he moves from talking about religious leaders and hookers to this focus on the family. And, of course, as you've heard it already told in a couple of ways, Dad asks his sons to go to work. One says, no way, but eventually gets around to it. The other says, sure, Dad, I'd love to. But several hours later, Dad finds him at home on the couch. He's playing Minecraft, sipping sodas, and chomping on Cheetos. And Jesus wonders which one pleased the parent more. And having dealt with my own children in similar situations years ago, I'd say neither. One is disrespectful, and the other one lies. This is really the story of the better of two bad sons. This perplexing, piercing parable offers a couple of responses to the good news. We can say no and change our minds and say yes. Or we can say yes but never respond. Can we have faith without action? Is the word without action the word at all? You know, I think at times we get caught up in over-evaluation, which leads to vacillation and procrastination and hesitation. Jesus says, follow me. But what do you really mean by that, Jesus? Jesus says, follow me. But if we really do that, we could lose our friends and cause some conflict and division. Jesus says, follow me. But, you know, Jesus, this is not really convenient right now. Jesus says, follow me, and we wonder, what will this cost me? The Barna Group, a Christian research firm, conducted a study called Temptations and America's Favorite Sins. What would be on your list this morning? Some thought that sex, drugs, and rock and roll would be at the top of the list, number one. But the survey found that the top three are procrastination, overeating, and spending too much time on media. Most felt they were wasting their time and not doing enough. Martin Copenhaver says, we may reach a point in our lives when we're willing to give the Christian faith a try, a bit of a try. You know, we'll attend a few services and read a book and offer up a prayer. That is, we may try it out like we try out fishing or oil painting for a few weekends to see if it appeals to us. We want a taste of it before we take in a full meal. But, he says, if we get satisfied with tentative steps, the larger satisfactions of the Christian faith may continue to escape us. Would you agree? Have you found that to be true? For instance, are there important things in life we cannot know, that we cannot really know, except by jumping in and doing them? Can we know? Can we know the exhilaration of the dance just by listening to a lecture, even a very good lecture about dancing? Can we really know the game, the rush of adrenaline just by watching it or hearing even the most gifted sports announcer describe it? Can we really know love, the satisfaction of sharing our life with someone else by reading about it in a book? There was an interesting story in the newspaper. A woman's sister had passed away unexpectedly. Funeral preparations were being made. Her brother-in-law gave her a gift box in which was a gorgeous silk and lace nightgown that had never been worn. And he explained to her that her sister had bought that nightgown many years ago and was saving it for a special occasion. But that special occasion never seemed to come. And he looked at her and said to her, never save anything for a special occasion, because everything is a special occasion. Every day is a gift. I think there's a sense in which the Christian faith is a little bit like that. We need to open it. We need to kind of try it on. We need to wear it. We need to use it. We need to practice it. Now, some people ask, hey, what do you Christians believe? And the implication is that Christianity, or any other religion for that matter, is just a matter of believing a certain list of things. But we do not and we cannot reduce any religion into some set of intellectual propositions or some type of philosophy of life. Jesus was a teacher whose life taught about what he preached. And we love and we serve him not simply because of what he said, but because of the way he lived and died and was resurrected. He takes us on a journey toward the truth, toward a realm we could not have entered without his invitation. And so, is this story about judgment or grace? Is the parable about faith or works? You know, when we wrestle with stories about faith and works and judgment and grace, we've got to deal with these paradoxical tensions. We are not saved by works, but faith without works is dead. All of our words and worship, the words we say and hear and sing, they're important, but they're not enough. We have heard it said that when worship ends, our service begins. Surely words must be transformed into deeds of love. Can we make progress for what is just and kind from our comfortable couches, or do we have to hit the streets like so many people are doing right now? Hearers must become actors in God's great drama. Faith affirmed must be faith performed. We are called to leave the land of almost, remembering the love of Jesus who did not almost go to the cross for us. And when we do, we will experience, I think, together the joy of being involved in the plans and purposes of God. Robert Capon's perspective about this parable is helpful too, I think. He says it's easy to expand upon the parable, but it's primarily an application to the life of the church in all ages. Because no matter how much we give lip service to the notion of free grace and dying love, we do not like it. It's just too indiscriminate. It lets rotten children and crooked tax farmers and common tarts into the kingdom, and it thumbs its nose at some really good people. And it does that gallingly for no more reason than the gospel's exaltation of simple trust over worthy works. Such nonsense we mutter in our hearts, such heartless, immoral folly. We'll teach God, we say. Oh, we'll continue to sing Amazing Grace, but we will jolly well be judicious when it comes to explaining to the riffraff what that actually means. We will assure them, of course, that God loves them, but we will make it clear that we expect them to clean up their act before we clasp them seriously to our bosom. We do not want prostitutes and chiselers and sinners thinking they could just barge in here and hang out. After all, we never did such things. Are we able to see? Are we able to see, to really see now? You know, we are second sons and daughters, elder brothers and sisters, respectable folks, the 12-hour all-day laborers. But we are those whose moral efforts have been trampled on by the feet beautiful upon the mountain. We are resentful about the divine joke of grace that says that nothing matters except plain old de facto Jesus faith. And when we institutionalize that resentment by giving the impression that the church is not for sinners, we become a bushel of works hiding the light of the world. God's will for us is that we believe in Jesus and become like him. God has already forgiven us and reconciled us and raised us up and made us sit together in heavenly places with him. The last shall be first just for believing. And so, you know, is this story about faith, works, judgment, or grace? And I'm not positive, But I think the answer is yes. And God's last word for all of us is grace.